So Jim and I would like to share with you some highlights from our time at CDOQ. And these actually have a purpose. Was sharpen your pencils. How that was applied will come clearer later. This year, CDOQ made a significant change, and instead of hosting assembly at a large hotel in Toronto, they booked Brock University. An easy drive with no Toronto traffic. We were housed in residence and had our meetings in lecture halls, and for those who opted for the meal plan, yes, it was cafeteria style and quality, but allowed for a lot of networking opportunities. The campus is lovely, with a wooded area near their spiritual center, creating a grotto from the Niagara Escarpment sedimentary rock. Yes, I did attend with a retired geography teacher. Perfect for an outdoor picnic area for our first lunch. This choice of venue saves CDOQ over $60,000. Randy and my son Stephen attended here at Brock, and I was housed not only in his old residence, but even his floor. This meant I knew about a common lounge, complete with some kitchen facilities. This became our breakfast meeting room. The residence was comfortable, ample study space, and a shared bathroom. No big deal. Just remember to unlock both doors when you leave, so your neighbor doesn't lose access from their side. Oops. For those with mobility issues, there were 6-seater golf carts with volunteer drivers to deliver us between the residence and the meeting areas. It was a very full 3 days with Bible studies at 8 a.m. until evening sessions finished at about 10 p.m. The lecture halls were great for the presentations, and the Shauna Sullivan Theater was perfect for the plenary and worship sessions. You couldn't help but have your spirit raised. You couldn't help but have your spirit raised by over 400 Baptists all singing worship songs together, led by talented musicians. And I especially liked the prayer times, particularly those that were offered in English, French, Spanish, Cantonese or Mandarin, and in Indigenous, I believe, Cree. Even with a busy meeting schedule, there were ample breaks for lunch and supper, which allowed for faster takeout lunch while watching three ships go sailing along through the Welland Canal. And on Friday night, I had a very special dinner out with Stephen. He now lives in St. Catharines, and it was lovely for him to be a tour guide for me and a time to catch up with each other.
I was pleased once again to be able to attend CDOQ as a delegate on behalf of our church, First Baptist Church Simcoe. This is something I've done on a regular basis since retiring from teaching in 2012. Here are some highlights from this year. Our executive minister, Leanne Friesen, is in her second year of leadership. She is a very positive person, able to think and react quickly on her feet, and a collaborative team leader. She pointed out the reality that there were 440 churches in our denomination in the 1990s, and we now stand at 294. Eleanor Emmett, formerly pastor of Bloomsburg Baptist, was wrapping up her year as president. We are indeed blessed by strong female leadership. You may recall that 2 years ago, motions were brought forward that in effect would allow churches or ministers to take steps to disassociate churches from associations, and ultimately from the convention. There was some support for this, but also pushback based upon the long-standing principle of local church autonomy that we have as Baptists. A decision was made to take this on at the committee level, and what ended up being devised was a review process that would have to be undertaken should a church be put forward. I'm happy to report that there were no churches in this situation this year.
The guest speaker for assembly was Sam Reimer, a sociology professor from Crandall University in New Brunswick. I attended two of his workshops. On Thursday night, he spoke on the challenge of faith transmission, how to transmit our faith to our kids. Why should we care? Faith is good for persons. Faith is good for society. It allows them to engage in their communities. And faith transmission is necessary for churches. He spoke about the challenges to not only transmit our faith to our kids, but even to get them through the doors of the church. The young adults of today are living in a time of high spirituality, but not religion. Instead of a personal relationship with Christ and recognizing his authority, there is a growing philosophy to self-spirituality. Instead of paddling canoes going down the river all in the same direction as in years past, where parents, friends all went to church, at school, the Lord's Prayer was said daily, and watching TV might be an episode of Leave It to Beaver. So the same values are presented in all aspects of life. Now it is more like they are paddling their canoes in a lake, all going in their own different directions. So what is self-spirituality? A, it's a private journey. They feel that all religions are basically the same. They have inner authority. I'm my own authority. There's personal liberty. They want to shun external expectations. And God is within. I am divinely good. And what's the end goal of self-spirituality? How do you know if you've gone there? It's when you find your authentic self. You know you have reached your end goal when you are good, powerful, peaceful, not anxious, angry, and you have inner peace. The image they often hold up is of a swan floating on calm seas. All of this makes it very hard to do faith transmission. So what are faith building experiences? There's three main areas that Mr. Reimer suggested. Third, go to places where you can witness God move, such as camp or mission trips. Two, have overlapping spheres of influence. I suggest to youth pastors, leaders, multiple youth and adults all saying the same thing, mentored by adults or adults who are authentic, not just fun activities, but deeper conversations and activities. I think that Carol and Eric do an awesome job with our youth with this. Have spiritual conversations between youth to youth, youth to adults, youth to kids. They need warm, caring relationships. There is a cacophony of voices, all contradictory to what Christian influences are saying. Our voices, they need to be louder. Number one, or the most important way to build faith transmission, is when it's taught by parents. Parents are the most significant spiritual influence as to what real faith looks like. It is where both parents are attending church and are open to conversations about. We need to be authentic in our prayers, in our devotions. We need to tell our testimony. We need to love our kids daily. How we parent will affect their view of God. Beware, we are in competition with online influences, phones, computers, podcasts, etc. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." Our challenge today is that there are many other influences wanting and willing to train up our children. There are many small L lords in their lives, but they are not interested in the good of our children. We should be training our children for committed openness, where they are secure in who they are, and they can hear others' opinions without being swayed by them. Faith is a group thing. Help kids find relationships that are useful for their faith. Select your influences and friends. Last Sunday, I absolutely loved seeing Julia, Cody, and Tiffany chatting together out of church. And social media, you need to select those. Sam Reimer recommends no cell phones with data until age 16. That's a tough one. And as they are still developing their self-identity, faith resilience takes discipline. We live in a culture that is pulling our kids towards self-spirituality. We need to train strong swimmers to go against this current, or to hide them in a netting, and most importantly, to anchor them to the rock, to show them what an authentic relationship with God looks like. There may be others, like myself, who are looking back on these formative years, wishing he had done things differently. A word of encouragement. All parents need more prayer and less guilt.
Happy to get that out there. I call this the minutia. Isn't that beautiful? For those of you that don't know, I am a sailor. When I was 8, my father decided he wanted to learn to sail. He bought a used sailboat, received 2 lessons from the person he bought the boat from, and the rest was trial and error, and there was lots of both. I had a very negative experience as a young person with swimming lessons at the YMCA, and I was still unable to swim at the age of 8. This meant I was very afraid of capsizing, even while wearing a life jacket. One Labor Day weekend on Fanshawe Lake, just outside of London, we ran aground. The sails were flapping, and no matter what we tried, we were unable to free ourselves from the mud. I thought we were going to die. At the very least, I thought we'd be stranded at the north end of the lake and nobody would be able to come and rescue us. So I can completely relate to the disciples as a squall threatens to swamp their boat and cause them all to drown. Meanwhile, Jesus is asleep in the boat. How many of us feel like that today? Wherever we turn, the news is unfailingly grim. We just got through COVID. A mere 5 years ago, in 2020 it started. And we thought, it can't get worse than this. The political situation, especially south of the border, is extremely toxic and disheartening. Wars continue to be waged in Ukraine, the Middle East, and many other places. Recently, wildfires raged in California and our western provinces, and biblical amounts of rain fell in Texas, leading to the tragic loss of hundreds of lives, including so many children. And most of us have some kind of familial strife, brought on by numerous factors, including disease, financial challenges, and general anxiety. It's hard not to feel like the disciples facing unrelenting wind and rain. And wondering, where are you, Jesus? As difficult as it is, we must look to Jesus as our Savior. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we're going to drown." He got up and rebuked the wind and raging waters. The storm subsided and all was calm. "Where is your faith?" he asked the disciples. In fear and amazement, they asked one another, "Who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him." Are you willing to admit your powerlessness over the wind and the waves? And reach out to the only one who can truly make a difference. As Jesus said, "Where is your faith?"
The Bible study was on the book of Habakkuk, and I'm never sure if I got the right pronunciation. It is only 3 chapters long. Habakkuk was a minor prophet. I admit that I had never read this book prior to it showing up on my schedule for assembly. I read it again, and then I read some commentaries on it. Wow, it is such a relevant scripture for our world today. We're going to watch a short video animation description to get a better understanding of it.
Look at the prophet Habakkuk. He's living in the final decades of Israel's southern kingdom. It was a time of justice and idolatry. He saw the rising threat of Babylon on the horizon, and that was not good news for anybody. But unlike the other prophets, Habakkuk does not accuse Israel. He doesn't even speak on God's behalf to the people. Rather, all of his words are addressed personally to God. And the book tells about Habakkuk's personal struggle, his journey of trying to believe that God was good when there is so much evil and trash in the world. And so Habakkuk's word, he actually calls a lament, and they're very similar to the laments that you find in the book of Psalms. The poet lodges a complaint and then draws God's attention to suffering and injustice in the world, demanding that God do something. And knowing God's lament form is actually the key to understanding the design and method of this short book. Chapters 1 and 2 are framed as a back-and-forth argument between Habakkuk and God. And the prophet lodges two complaints to which God offers two responses. His first complaint is that life in Israel has become horrible. The Torah is neglected, resulting in violence and injustice, and it's all being tolerated by Israel's corrupt leaders. And Habakkuk is crying out, asking God to do something, but nothing seems to change. But then all of a sudden, God responds. He says that he's very aware of the corruption of his own people, Israel, and that he's summoning the armies of Babylon to bring down his justice on Israel. And very similar to the message of Micah or Isaiah, God says he will use his terrifying empire to devour Israel because of their injustice and evil. But Habakkuk had a problem with this answer, and so he offers a second. He says Babylon is even worse than Israel. They're more corrupt, they're more violent. They deified their own military power, they treat humans like animals, gathering them up like fish in a net, he says. They devour nations and people groups in order to build their own empire. And so Habakkuk says, how can you, a holy, good God, use such corrupt nations as your instruments in history? He demands an explanation. In fact, he depicts himself as a watchman on the city walls, waiting for God's response, which eventually comes. God talks about the gods and tablets and chisel and write down what he sees and hears. It's a vision about an appointed time in the future. That even though it may seem slow to come, it will eventually come. In fact, God says that the righteous person will live by their faith in this hope and vision. So what is this divine promise that God is supposed to write down? It's that God will bring Babylon down. God says that the violence and oppression of creates a never-ending cycle of revenge, and that God will use this cycle to bring about the rise and fall of nations. And the fact that God might for a time use a corrupt nation like Babylon does not mean that he endorses everything they do. He holds all nations accountable to his justice, and so Babylon will fall along with any other nation that acts like it. God's promise is then elaborated by a series of five woes that describe the kinds of oppression and injustice perpetrated by nations like Babylon. The first two target unjust economic practices, like how wealthy people will charge ridiculous interest just to keep working in debt, and so they build their wealth through crooked means. The third woe is a critique of slave labor, treating humans like animals, threatening them with violence if they don't produce. The fourth woe targets the abuse of alcohol by irresponsible while people are suffering through their bad leadership, they're partying and wasting their money on sex and booze. And the last woe exposes idolatry, the engine that drives such nations. They have made money and power and national security into their gods, offering these allegiance at all costs. And so people become slaves to their own national empire. Now the practices described here aren't unique to Babylon, but that's part of the point. Given the human condition, most nations eventually become Babylon. And so this is how God's answer to Habakkuk in this book becomes God's answer to all later generations, to anyone who lives in the world ruled by other Babylons. But at least the question remains. Is God going to let the cycle of rise and fall of Babylonian empire go on forever? And that question is what chapter 3 is about. We're told that this is a prayer of that. And it begins by Habakkuk pleading with God to act now in the present like the past in the past and bring down the throughout the nation. And what follows is a very ancient poem. It first describes a powerful, terrifying appearance of God. It's very similar to the opening poems of Micah and Nahum, and similar to the appearance of God on Sinai. But that's there's cloud, fire, and earthquake. When the Creator shows up to confront human evil, everybody will be paying attention. But that then goes on to describe this future defeat of evil as a future exodus. So just like God came as a warrior, he split the sea in his battle against Pharaoh. Habakkuk says that God will once more bring his judgment down on the head of the evil house. So Pharaoh, like Babylon, has become here the archetype of violent human nations. But at the same time, we're told that when God confronts evil, he will save his people and his anointed one, the rebels of the king from the wrong thing. And so in this poem, the Exodus story of the past has become an image of the future Exodus God will perform. He will once again defeat evil and bring down the Pharaoh, then the Babylon to this world. He'll bring justice to all people and rescue the oppressed and the innocent. And it's this hope that enables Habakkuk to conclude the book with hopeful praise. Even if the world's falling apart, a food shortage, or drought, or war, or whatever, he will choose trust and joy in the covenant promises. And so Habakkuk, by the end of this book, becomes a shining example of how the righteous live by faith. Habakkuk recognizes just how dark and chaotic the world and our lives can become. And he invites us into a journey of faith, of trusting that God loves this world more than we do, and that he will one day deal with its evil. And that's what the book of Habakkuk is all about.
Doesn't it feel like there are parallels between Habakkuk's world and the times we live in today? We also have a choice to lament, or as Habakkuk concluded, we can choose trust and joy in a covenant promise of God. This is important to share when so many people are feeling despondent about the world situation. And like Habakkuk in chapter 2, verses 2 to 3, we need to write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets so that the hair may run away. So we need to sharpen our pencils and make it known that God has a plan, is just, and will prevail.
One of the more powerful speakers at Assembly was Matt Wilkinson. His primary position with CBOQ is director at Camp Kwasan. He clearly has the heart of an evangelist and shared with us that he led 280 of his friends and classmates to Christ while in high school. Wow. Now, for those of you who love math, this next one is for you. How many of you remember learning about ratios in school? Honestly, of all the math classes I've taken, this is probably the concept that I use most in my adult life. For example, if I were to get 27 out of 39 on a test, I would want to know what percent that is. And when doing DIY projects, which I sometimes do, in order to accurately assess how much material to buy, I'm often solving for an unknown. So back to my test mark. 27 over 39 equals X over 100. This is bringing back memories, maybe painful ones for some people. Cross multiply So the 39x equals 27 times 100. X equals 2700 divided by 39. My test mark, I'll put that back up, is 69.23%. I can't even round up to 70. Why all this talk about ratios? Matt told us about research that's being conducted into the ratio of 5 to 1. 5 to 1. Research shows that a young person needs 5 separate people that are not related to them, individuals, in their life in a meaningful way for them to stay committed to the church. That's a lot more than 1 to 1, isn't it? 5 to 1. How many of us as parents have seen our children not attending church? I would hazard a guess that applies to most of us. Our church has a vibrant youth group, and we can all be grateful for the love and time that Rick and Carolyn and others have put into these lives for many years now. Who will step up and be one of the 5 individuals for Melody, Oscar, Noah, Levi, Violet, Lewis, Ruby, Ezra, Flora? Wendy and I are keen to sharpen our pencils, and we encourage you to sharpen yours. 5 to 1.
Okay, not the most exciting part of assembly, but the very important part, the business meeting. There were 2 sessions to review financial statements, discussing the real motions brought forward, there was nothing contentious this year, and being informed on the work that CBOQ is doing on our behalf of all the churches within the convention. I want to share with you the result of many hours and much prayer by our church board, the CBOQ strategic plan for 2025 to 2028. It contains 5 goals. Goal number 1 is to encourage and equip churches to listen, discern, and respond to the Holy Spirit. The strategies for that are assistance for churches to discern where they are on the church life cycle and if changes are needed. It was a graph that they had, and it showed from a growing church all the way to a church that really there was no turning back. They were needing to close. So we're not there. Education and discussion on relevant social issues, such as MAID. Assistance for pastors and individuals help in discerning God's direction. The second goal was to ignite transformation through innovation and mission. The cultural realities of ministry have changed. There's diverse models. Co-vocational pastors, I've never heard of that before. We got to see 2 short videos, one of the pastor who was also a security guard, another gentleman who had started working on McDonald's and then became a pastor but still kept both jobs. Next generation engagement is so important. And providing training for churches on how to apply for grants, CBOQ grants and other grants. The third goal is ministry leaders through diverse pathways. The next generation leadership development program, educational partnerships and opportunities, improved accreditation, ordination, and renewal processes, support for multicultural pastors and congregations, mentorship and support for pastors. And the fourth goal is to foster deeper connection among our CBOQ family and with our ministry partners. welcoming congregations and bridging cultures, improving connections amongst our CBOQ churches, our identity, quality, and communication. And the fifth goal was to ensure intentional stewardship and strategic use of resources. So this is for the board and you, looking at their human resources, their financial responsibility, and their income generation. Overall, the strategic plan is comprehensive, responsive to the times we live in today, and provides a clear vision moving forward. I have only provided the bullet points, but if anyone is interested, I have a copy of the Book of Business, which provides much more information on each goal. We have an amazing executive minister in CBOQ in the person of Leanne Friesen. We have dedicated board members and energetic and enthusiastic people leading the next gen team and more. Assembly was an amazing time of learning, renewal, reconnecting with old friends and making new ones. It was so worthwhile. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to attend. We'd like to conclude by sharing a wonderful example which demonstrates our CBOQ unity. This was played for us at the conclusion of our Friday night session.
teacher maybe wants you to take a moment and think about three things that you heard today that resonated with you. Those three things to stay in your mind, tell them to somebody. There's accountability there. We're a team. Wendy and I were a team of two. But to put this service together, we had Janet doing all the slides, Brent on PowerPoint, Pam making sure the videos were where they're supposed to be. Look around. We're not a big, big team. We're not a mega church. I don't want to be a mega church. I want to be this church. We can do amazing things for our community. And we can do it because CBOQ is there to support us. Get us a new camera that makes better sound. Have home for the night. First serving people who are in this congregation right now because of those ministries. I love our team. I love that we're having a pinch hit while we look for a new minister. So thank you for listening.